afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People. Bill was having an episode. That was the...
Couldn't get my mic right.
You're not supposed to touch it that much. That was funny.
I couldn't hear what I was doing.
So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. Pape Machinery is our local John Deere tractor dealer. They're also a Honda and soon-to-be steel dealer. So come up there and see them if you got any tractor needs. They are full parts, service, sales, the whole bit. They're on 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake. And their phone number is 226-9226. Give them a call if you got anything going on out in the farm. You need repairs or anything.
Or even your yard.
Or in your yard, yeah. We can take care of it for you.
Yeah. There so they can test drive them and do everything.
Oh, yeah. They can do it all.
I was like asking Bill questions. He's like, okay, we're done with this part.
Yeah, okay. Okay, we're done.
I can't help it.
What the heck?
It's like a sickness.
It is.
Do it all the time at home. It's hard to turn it off. So let's see. We have been loitering for the last 2 weeks, and we've sent you some really nice archives. We hope you liked them during Christmas. Oddly enough, we had a huge listenership on Christmas Day. Yeah, go figure that. I figured that would be like the lowest day of the whole year, but a lot of you were listening on Christmas Day.
I find that totally normal. Get the family together and sit around the radio and listen to a great radio show.
Yeah. Yeah, you were listening about China. We played China on Christmas, so yeah. Hope you enjoyed that. And so just some like program notes. We've got tabs on the website at wethepeopleradio.us, and you can kind of see consolidated lists of shows of about veterans, South Africa. We're going to have our guest Harry Bouillon's on again about South Africa here soon. China. We've done a bunch of shows on Islam, environmentalism. We've got to get our environmental guys back again. I'm scheduling with the folks at CFACT and a couple other places, and those guys are always full of information. We've done a bunch of shows on marijuana. If you want to know if it's dangerous or not, or if you have people who think it isn't dangerous, you can listen to actual experts. That would not be us.
Do we tell them where to buy it locally at their local retail outlet?
Well, we just determined that we don't know anything about drugs because our local grocery store now has really weird blue lights in the bathroom.
Yeah,
and apparently
it's like infrared or something.
So you can't see your veins. And someone pointed out that actually you can do drugs a different way. It's like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that. So we failed the
drug. We failed our drug test.
We failed our drug paraphernalia test. Obviously, we have no future there. Thank goodness. So, and then we were contacted by our friend Rick Trader at the Conservative Commandos. He used to air a later version of our show in Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore maybe 2 years ago for the last, I don't think we've done it for like 2 years. Anyway, he has taken over some, in a nice way, some television stations in the state of California, Bay Area, like San Francisco, Marin, Santa Rosa, and then I think they're also, and also up in the Redding area, and then they're moving into Reno and someplace else in Nevada. So kind of that geographic footprint, and they've got several television stations, and what they're doing is they're going to air radio programs in a lot of their slots so that people who maybe don't get the radio programs, possibly don't have access to really good internet, but who watch just regular TV, not cable, not satellite, but television. So we'll get you more information on that too. So that was kind of a fun idea. And
yeah, you've never seen a radio show like ours on TV.
So we don't really know how that's going to work at all. We have actually no idea. So we've got to talk to him about that some more. But kind of a neat thing going. He is always looking for conservative programming. So if you guys have any ideas, shoot us an email. Our contact information is at wethepeopleradio.us. And we'd like to make sure that we have guests and the people that you want to hear from this year. And sponsorship ideas, we're always up for that, since all these things, need sponsors. So, anyway, that's our...
That's your pitch?
I think that's all the news of the day.
Yeah, so far.
Moving forward now.
The day is young.
Yeah, it's only the 5th of January, and we've already got all that done. And we almost took the Christmas tree down. I did balance the checkbook and change the bed. So, you know, I feel like I've started the new year off correctly.
I changed four light bulbs.
Oh, and I applied for my real ID driver's license.
That's right, because you weren't officially, you couldn't prove you were a citizen of the state of California.
Oh, my God. You know, if you live in one of those states where they've allowed illegal aliens to have driver's licenses, and I don't know, maybe the other ones have it too, but I know California does for sure. And as of October of this year, you won't be able to fly on an airplane using your regular driver's license. You'll have to have a real ID. So my suggestion is go to the DMV online, because it takes a little bit. And just if you're helping your 82-year-old mother over the phone do that online, I just want you to know it's going to take a lot longer. And you will have enough time to actually reapply for your passport while you're doing that. It'll take that long. That's how long it takes, one passport application. But you really ought to get cracking on that, because I know in a lot of places in California, the appointments are way, way out. And
well, it's not just airplane. I mean, you can't...
you can't buy a firearm. You can't do
can't
all sorts of things.
Buy ammunition in California without...
No, there's that.
I mean, there's a lot of things.
Your driver's license will no longer be considered a valid form of identification. So if you currently hold a passport, you could buy yourself a little bit of time. But, you know, it's for... just everybody else, you're going to need a real ID. So I would go to the DMV website, look at the list of things. You've got to have like a utility bill and a mortgage statement. You have to have things to prove your residency. You've got to have a copy of your birth certificate, social security card. So it isn't stuff you can do in just 5 minutes. You've got to do a little planning.
I'm glad they called it real ID, though, because it infers that you just have a pretend ID in your wallet right now. It's really not good for much. It's got a nice picture on it and some numbers, but it's not good for much.
And you wait. California will foul up the real ID, too. We'll have to do something else after that. But anyway, just things to do at the first of the year. You might want to give some thought to that before suddenly someone says, hey, we're having, you know, somebody's getting married, or you got to get on an airplane, and then you're doomed. You'll never be able to turn that around in time, and the DMV doesn't do things quickly. Hey, one other note, too. When you do that, they do ask you if you're a registered voter or if you want to register to vote. There are several questions when you're doing your preliminary real ID paperwork over the computer.
I think even when you apply just for a fake ID at the DMV,
if you want to renew your non-real ID at the DMV, they do ask you that. So I did like a little experiment, and I clicked the box that said I was already registered to vote, and I didn't want to do that because we just had a slew of postcards go out to people who had renewed their driver's license and now were suddenly magically registered as no party preference. Well, in the state of California, if you want to vote Republican, I don't know about all the other ones, but if you want to vote Republican in California, you have to be a registered Republican. So if they have somehow switched you as a no party preference, surprise to you, your ballot will not have any presidential candidates on it that are listed with the Republican Party. So, something you might want to check on if, in fact, you have done any DMV stuff in the last year or so. Wow. It was more than I thought. Yeah. Sorry, we had a lot of stuff. So, we are going to take probably a little bit of an early break. Could that be okay? Ashley? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. If we take a little bit of an early break, then we're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and I'll give you his snippet here really quickly while she scrambles up our music there. He's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both are congressional advisory boards. He served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, so they can all stand up really straight, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. Just, you know, for good measure. He has a PhD in history and archaeology and another PhD in strategic studies, which led him to the CIA. Makes sense. He's the author of Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe and Electric Armageddon. Fun as that. You can find out everything about him at
WeThePeopleRadio. And we're going to have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, he'll do the talking from here on out.
Thank God.
We'll be right back.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Ooh.
And welcome back. All right. We are being joined by our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, who will be our hostage for the entire show. Yay. And just to, you know, for those of you who maybe don't have web access and don't read the rest of it, he was an intelligence officer with the Central Intelligence Agency responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy, operational plans, military doctrine, threat perceptions, and developing U.S. paradigms for strategic warning from 1985 to 1995. So he's done all sorts of interesting things, and he's got a really long list of books: Blackout Wars, Apocalypse Unknown, Electric Armageddon. And I was kind of reading into the bottom because, you know, you never get that far in these shows. We always get, you know, derailed with information. The BBC made his book War Scare into a 2-hour documentary, which is pretty cool. And Electric Armageddon was the basis for another TV documentary made by National Geographic. So, bottom line, anybody who knows about this stuff would be Dr. Pry. So he's going to talk to us about what's going on in the Middle East and all that jazz that we're hearing so much. Well, how about we'll just call it differing opinions.
There you go.
What's really going on?
Yeah. Well, welcome. What's happening in your world, Dr. Pry?
Well, it's been an exhausting holiday because of this and other developments that haven't even been gotten much attention in the mainstream
sure.
media.
Oh.
And thank you, by the way, for having me back on your show to talk about these
absolutely
issues that weigh much on my mind and everybody else's. We'll talk about the Middle East situation first, I think, and the significance of this. I mean, I, like all conservatives and most rational people, you know, shed no tears for the execution of Qasem Soleimani, the leader, Iran's top general, the leader of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Guy was a monster. He killed hundreds, if not thousands, of Americans. And when you look at the destabilization that the IRGC, which is the world's largest and most sophisticated terrorist organization, and it's one of the few state-sponsored terrorist organizations in the world. You know, his effects have probably made victims of possibly millions of people, not just in the Middle East, but even in India, in the Philippines, everywhere where international terrorism touches. So I shed no tears for his execution, and President Trump probably, well, I'm sure, had no choice, you know. The way the liberal mainstream media presents this, it's as if it's sort of some sort of impulsive, out-of-the-blue decision that the president made, perhaps for political purposes, to give himself a bump in the polls or something like that, which is, you know, which is nonsense. In fact, the president has been criticized by many quarters for being too quick on the draw, too quick on the trigger here to take this guy out, when in fact the president has exercised, you know, enormous self-restraint, enormous self-restraint over the past 2 years toward Iran, which has engaged in a series of escalating attacks on our allies and on U.S. interests, and the attacks have gotten bigger and bigger and more significant. The last attack having been on the Saudi Arabian oil fields, which in past administrations would have been considered a casus belli for war, because our Asian and European allies are vitally dependent, you know, upon oil coming through the Straits of Hormuz, upon oil coming from Saudi Arabia. And we have talked for years about scenarios where the Iranian Navy, the IRGC, by the way, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, has a navy. Okay, they're one of the few, the only terrorist organization in the world that's got a navy, but they've threatened to close the Straits of Hormuz and all the rest. And if they did that and they used their navy to do that by having a blockade, how that could lead to a war with Iran. But they went beyond that. They went beyond what was considered widely a worst-case scenario, where the IRGC navy basically blockades the Straits of Hormuz and actually physically attacked the Saudi oil fields themselves.
Wow.
Showing that they could shut down that oil by this means. And the technology that was demonstrated when they did that you know, they tried to give themselves plausible deniability by saying it was done by drones, okay, coming from Yemen. And they did use a combination of drones and cruise missiles, which demonstrated incredible accuracies in striking within meters or actually showing no miss distance at all, even though they were fired from hundreds of kilometers away in Iran. So it demonstrated a very advanced technology. And this is the kind of thing that has been, you know, the IRGC, that is to say, again, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, that's been led by this general, is also in charge of these high-tech Iranian military programs, such as the ones that executed the attack on Saudi Arabia. He was the head of their missile program. The IRGC runs the missile program. And as we've discussed in past shows here, Iran probably has a clandestine nuclear program. I think, as do many of my colleagues, that Iran already has nuclear weapons. And those belong to the IRGC. The Iranian space program, so-called space program, actually is not a peaceful NASA-type space program. It belongs to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. So this guy was a very dangerous, bad guy. He was leading efforts, you know, to make these increasingly escalatory attacks, virtually acts of war. Also recall when the Iranians shot down our drone, President Trump was almost convinced to retaliate for that, but he didn't in the end because he was afraid of killing Iranian soldiers. And so he canceled the strikes, the planned strikes on Iran for shooting down our drone, and got a lot of criticism for showing weakness, like he was Obama, you know, not responding to crossing a red line. But much to the president's credit, you know, when he received intelligence that Iran wasn't respecting, it wasn't responding to our offers of negotiation, and was continuing this escalatory path, and now was planning something really big. The dimensions haven't been disclosed to the public. Maybe they never will, but they were planning something really big to hurt American interests in the Middle East. You know, the press reporting on it suggests multiple attacks against U.S. and allied military bases that would end up killing hundreds of our people. He did the right thing and launched a preemptive strike to stop that, to stop their planned attacks on our people and our allies, and took out the top guy who was behind all of this stuff, General Soleimani. Now, I do have a regret about this, and here I part company with my many friends on conservative media who only celebrate the fact that President Trump did this. He had to do it, no question, and I don't criticize him for that. But I wish he had listened to himself and honored his promise to get our troops out of Syria and Iraq, you know, so that the deep state guys in the State Department, the Department of Defense, weren't able to, in effect, corner him into having to make this decision. I think in retrospect, you know, because Trump has been criticized by the Washington establishment, both the Republican and Democrat, so-called national security and foreign policy experts in Washington, have been against President Trump's wanting to pull our troops out of the Middle East, out of Iran, out of Syria. And I think this proves that he was right and they were wrong, you know, because he has been listening to them. You know, we've only got 5,000 troops in Iraq and fewer than 2,000 in Syria. They're surrounded by hundreds of thousands of hostile actors, hostile Syrians, hostile Iraqis, hostile Iranians. The Iranians, the IRGC, has got 100,000 troops in Iraq. They're basically taking over Iraq. What are 5,000 troops supposed to do against that? Yeah. They're basically a massacre waiting to happen, sooner or later. And actually, I think that's what Soleimani had planned. He was finally going to give us a bloody nose and kill a lot of our people because President Trump had been listening to these advisors, these Bush administration and Obama-era advisors, who basically don't want to continue business as usual in the Middle East. So if the president had just listened to himself and made it happen and gotten our guys out, maybe we would not now be standing on the threshold of a war with Iraq. And that's where, with Iran, and that's where we are. We are on the threshold of a war with Iran. And the president may have stopped that war from happening by executing this operation, because if they had pulled it off, then we would be at war with Iran for sure. But now the ball is in Iran's side of the field, and they have to decide what they're going to do next. Are they going to continue their pattern of escalation, which will probably result in a war, or not? I'm sorry.
I was just curious. I heard, I think it was yesterday or day before, that the Iraqi leadership was going to vote as to whether or not to allow us to stay in Iraq. Did they vote on that?
I don't think they voted on that yet. But the general common view on that is that the reason the vote's being held is pretty much pro forma, and that Iraq wants us out. And if that happens, I hope the president seizes on that as a reason to get our people out.
Right.
Doesn't resist it. I mean, I can believe that there are people in state and DOD, you know, who are so determined to keep this American empire, to stay the course on our Middle East policy, that they would actually advocate keeping U.S. troops in Iraq, despite the fact that that sovereign country wants us to withdraw. Although I have to clarify that by when I call them a sovereign country. You know, one could make a rational argument that Iraq really isn't a sovereign country anymore. You know, the reason there's 100,000 Iranian troops on their territory, right, you know, is because Iran is having Iraq for breakfast. And, they're being folded into the Iranian caliphate, part of their empire.
Sure.
And they aren't really independent actors anymore. There's just so much influence that the Iranians now have, and that the Iraqis see that the strong horse is not America anymore, but Iran. You know, because we've only got 5,000 troops, and the Iranians have got 100,000. And a lot of the Iranians, let's face it, after all the blood and treasure we spent in Iraq, America and Americans are not beloved in Iraq. The Iraqi people have not shown a great enthusiasm for democracy. It was Iraqis, not Iranians, Iraqis who are sympathetic, Iraqi militias who are basically under the control of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who invaded our embassy again, attacked our embassy.
See, that's the thing, is they start attacking the embassy, and somehow the media glossed right over that and, you know, made it sound like we just, one day, the president woke up and felt like dropping a drone on this guy. We've got to take a really quick break. We're going to come right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Justice will be served and the battle will rage. This big dog will fight when you rattle his cage. And you'll be sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. 'Cause we'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And a statue of liberty started shaking her fist. And the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be hell when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell. And it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you. All brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
I stole that song from CNN. That's mostly how they cover everything the president does. End of the world! Oh my God, we're never coming back.
I preferred your previous song.
I did too. It's one of my favorites.
If I could carry on this with,
yes,
with this theme a little bit more, on General Soleimani, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and who this man was and why it's so important. I think all of the media has captured the point, the idea that this guy was, you know, the number two guy in Iran, basically the top general, the chief advisor to the mullahs, and all of that secular stuff, you know, in terms of his political strategic importance to the Iranian regime has been pretty much well captured, also because of his expertise as a terrorist in managing the expansion of the Islamic empire for Iran through the Middle East. But something that's missing from everything, or from most things, is the ideological dimension of this. Because we constantly end up making the mistake of thinking of Iran as a normal nation state that thinks in terms of pragmatic geopolitical and economic terms, and that's the most important thing to them, the secular issues of political, military, and economic power, and that they're going to be guided by things that guide normal nation states in that respect. And therefore, if they can make advance their political, military, economic power, they're going to do that. But if the risk of a setback is too high, and it would cost them more in political, military, economic terms, they can be deterred, which is what we're trying to do now with President Trump's announcement that he's prepared to strike 52 military, political, and cultural targets in Iran. 52 targets representing the 52 American hostages that were taken by the Islamic regime when they started their revolution. If they commit aggression against the United States. And I think that was a good announcement. I think that's a clever tactic. I think it helps. If there's any hope at all, which I don't really think there is, of the Islamic regime coming to its senses and backing off and deciding not to engage in a very destructive kind of retaliatory strike against us in some way, that's the kind of thing that might do it, because they're in the middle of a crisis themselves. They've had to kill hundreds of their own people. Every city and town in Iran has been up in arms over their failing economy. The mullahs are unpopular, and the image of these guys, you know, the leader of the Judeo-Christian civilization, President Trump, basically beating a prostrate Iraq 52 times if they dare to cross us again, you know, might be something that they're, well, it might be something that they're very, very much want to avoid, at least at this moment when their regime is so unpopular and has been tottering on the brink at home. But that logic might not work with these guys, because they are driven by the Islamic ideology. Just even the name of the IRGC, and I myself have almost committed a mistake, because the mainstream media constantly calls them by the wrong name. They call them the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, okay? As if the organization that General Soleimani led was a secular military force dedicated to Iranian security. That's not its name. Its name is actually the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Not the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the Islamic. And its nickname is the Quds Force. And we've all heard that on TV, I'm sure. The Quds Force, that's their nickname. And people have kind of mindlessly repeated that. But I'll bet that 90% of the people on TV calling them the Quds Force don't know what that means. The nickname for the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is the Quds Force, because in Farsi, Quds is Jerusalem. And in their eschatology, in their interpretation of Islam, you know, we are in the end time. The mullahs believe that. The radical Shiites believe that we're in the end time. And that the struggle that's going on now between East and West is not just a geopolitical and economic and military one, but a spiritual one. And the spiritual dimension is the more important. We're really the the God of the Christians and Allah are locked in war. The God of Islam are at war with each other. In fact, they don't believe in the existence of the Christian God. They think we're all infidels and that there is only one God, and that God is Allah. But in effect, their mission that has been not just adopted by themselves voluntarily, but is a mission from God that they have to execute at risk of damnation, you know, is to pave the way for the triumph of Islam worldwide in all of these dimensions, in both the secular dimension of world, you know, military and economic power, and more importantly, in the spiritual universe. And the 12th Imam, you know, who's going to inaugurate this when he returns, their 12th Imam, you know, is supposed to rule the world from an intact Jerusalem. And that's why the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps has the nickname of the Quds Force. You know, because at some point along the line, sometime soon, you know, they're supposed to conquer Israel, kill the Jews, take over an intact Jerusalem. And when they do all that, they'll have checked the boxes in their own eschatological interpretation of Islam for the return of the 12th Imam to basically have this the end time where they end up triumphing. So, I have now understanding that, try to put yourselves in the shoes of a radical Islamic true believer like the mullahs. And what we did, of necessity, I don't criticize it, okay, but I'm just trying to explain what the larger implications are, you know, is basically knocked off the top crusader, God's, Allah's top crusader on earth for this vision of history, this interpretation, for this whole worldview. And that obviously comes as a shock to them, not just because they've lost a very talented person, you know, for pragmatic reasons, but the mullahs believe in signs and portents. You know, that's one of the reasons they've been going down this road, because they have met with such success. When you think about it, it is really almost miraculous that since 1979 in the Islamic Revolution, this failed state, you know, which is not very, compared to the United States and other great powers, is not really all that significant. Certainly it doesn't have much of an economic base, okay? And, but it has been able to, it's been beat the Obama administration for 8 years in the geopolitical struggle. You know, it's become the largest missile force in the Middle East. Even if you believe the liberals, the most optimistic interpretation, you know, the Obama administration believed that they were within 6 months of getting the atomic bomb. I think they've had the atomic bomb for quite some time, since 2003. Quite an achievement, and they would regard that as a miracle, another sign from God that they're on the right path toward victory. After all, if they were on the wrong path, how could they be achieving these things? But suddenly the killing of Soleimani, if you believe in signs and portents, you know, contradicts this flow of history. And they have to respond to it in some way. I think it's highly unlikely that they're going to say, oh, not because they've killed this one man, that they're going to now reconsider and go back to the pathway of negotiations and say, well, our whole worldview has been wrong. This isn't the end time. We need to wait. We need to back off. We need to return to a negotiating table with the United States or something like that. Maybe after a terribly catastrophic losing war, they might be willing to do something like that. I doubt even then. After all, Iran is the regime that educates little boys that, because it's the end time, that they can go to paradise if they strap explosive vests on themselves and blow themselves up to kill a few Jews or other infidels. This is how they think they would be willing to sacrifice their whole nation in a nuclear holocaust. if it advanced their ideological and spiritual goal. And so I think when you understand where this person stood and how the mullahs think from this perspective, that it makes it even more likely and that the Iran has got to be thinking of something really big that they feel that they have, that they will that they must, I don't want to use the word push back, because that implies that we're the aggressors, okay? We're the ones to push back, you know, with this military action that President Trump had to take. They're going to want to keep their ball of aggression rolling, the momentum that they think they have, that I'm sure this one thing isn't going to cause them to think God isn't on their side anymore.
No.
Maybe they'll see it as some kind of a test. And you know, a good radical Islamic terrorist responds to tests from God by going even further in the direction of trying to kill the infidels and doing something spectacular, you know, that will force the infidel to change his mind, to back off, to surrender, to finally realize that God is great.
Right. So if you're already making bad choices, just double down, and the choices will get better.
Exactly. Not unlike the liberal Democrats, but in a less.
I was just going to say we're actually incubating a cell of that here that's fairly large. We've got to take another quick break, celebrate a little capitalism, since we still have that. Hooray. We'll be back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Bry. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Couldn't resist. Little Chris Isaac there.
Dr. Bry, we, with all that being said about, you know, their beliefs and where they go from here, what do you think their options are? What do you think they're prepared or willing to do to retaliate in a big way? I mean, what's their options?
Well, they have a lot of options. There are Islamic radical cells in the United States that are under the control of the IRGC. Iran has a highly developed cyber attack capability. They're one of the most advanced countries in the world when it comes to that. You could use a saboteurs and a combination of cyber attacks. They also have, I described earlier how they have these drone and cruise missile technologies. You know, they have, for sure, non-nuclear EMP weapons, like Boeing demonstrated on our CHAMP missile, which is a cruise missile equipped with a non-nuclear EMP warhead. It puts out a repeated EMP pulse. It doesn't blow up. It puts out what's called a high-energy radio frequency pulse that can destroy electric grids and electronics. And while it wouldn't take the whole of North America out in the blink of an eye, the way a nuclear EMP attack would, you know, if you flew this thing around long enough, you know, it could black out the whole North American grid. Or saboteurs armed with non-nuclear EMP suitcases, which you can buy online without a license. You can buy them from the United States. They're intended as a diagnostic tool, not as a weapon. But somebody with the money, if they bought one of these things, you know, could put it in the trunk of a car, go to an EHV transformer substation, and black out a whole city. If you had a team of people, well, there was a study by the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, according to the Wall Street Journal, classified study that was allegedly leaked that said if only 9 of 2,000 EHV transformer substations in the U.S. national electric grid were attacked, it could black out the whole country for 18 months.
Wow.
You know, that could kill,
well,
that could kill 90% of Americans without a nuclear EMP attack, you know, from starvation and disease and have all. You can do it with small arms and rocket-propelled grenade launchers, you know, if you destroy enough of these EHV transformers. And it doesn't take a lot to do it. They know this, you know, just from reading our newspapers. You know, don't forget the Great Northeast Blackout of 2003. What happened there? Nobody attacked an EHV transformer. It wasn't nearly as serious as that. You know, a tree branch fell, you know, on a high-voltage power line. And then because of some bad mistakes that were made by, you know, by people controlling the grid, it cascaded quickly into a blackout of 50 million Americans and put the whole northeastern United States in the blackout. Now, that only lasted a day, you know, but it did cost us billions of dollars. And it's obvious if something like that, the grid is so fragile that something like that can bring it down. And you guys are in California, so I certainly don't have to talk to you about how fragile the electric grid is and how incompetent our utilities are when it comes to public safety and national security. We talked about that before. So that's one big, spectacular option. And they could even keep their fingerprints off of it, you know, by using clandestine groups or cyber attacks to do it. So that's a possible option. The Iranians have today announced a range of targets, something like 35 different U.S. and allied targets in the Middle East that are within range of their missiles, of their medium-range missiles in the Middle East, that they could consider striking, that would do Air Force bases, Army bases. I don't think they'd do something like that, or they might do it. If they did something like that, they'd do it in combination with something much bigger, because I think they know, given their worldview, and also given their worldview for their own, from their own perspective and from the world perspective, that if they were, their retaliation would have to do something a lot more than just, you know, hitting with missiles a few U.S. and allied military bases that are located in the Middle East. You know, I am sure, for good reason, the President Trump's security detail has been tremendously beefed up. And the same for the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and for Secretary of Defense Esper. You know, because they could go gunning for them.
Right.
That would be a retaliatory option that they might consider equivalent or even greater if they could knock off the President of the United States or our Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or our Secretary of Defense. So these are the kinds of things they'd, you know, be thinking about. Biological warfare, you know, smuggling some kind of biological agent into the United States to start a plague, you know, or into our allies would be on the table.
And do you think
and
that
biggie,
do,
the
do,
most
do you think that that with their knowledge of our capabilities of a retaliatory strike, that they would be willing to go that route? I mean, they know that we have the capability of pretty much flattening their infrastructure in pretty short order as a response. Do you think they would consider?
Well, you're still thinking like a Westerner. Okay. You know, the whole reason I went through that spiel before is to try to put us into the shoes of how the radical Islamists who run Iran think. You're absolutely right. The people of Iran, they don't want any of this. You know, they want to, they're like us. They want to have good lives. They want to have a good economy. They're unhappy with the mullahs, but they're not in charge.
Right.
The mullahs are in charge. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is in charge. And their regular military is in charge. You know, one other thing I should point out, you know, to understand this, is that the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is not the regular military. In addition to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which has hundreds of thousands of troops in it, they have their own air force, they have their own navy, they control the missile force, and if Iran has nuclear weapons, they control the nuclear weapons, okay? In addition to all that, Iran has its regular army, you know, which comprises hundreds of thousands of men and other another Navy, another Air Force, and all the rest. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps to Iran is what the Waffen-SS was to Hitler's Germany. Not only an independent army, independent from the Wehrmacht, from the regular standing army, but also the ideological tip of the spear for advancing Nazism. You know, they're true believers. And that's what the IRGC is. And these true believers are willing to send their own children to death in explosive vests to advance the cause. And I think, yes, if they think that taking out the great Satan, that the price for that they have to pay for taking out the great Satan is the destruction of Iran, I think the way these guys think, since this is a struggle for the spiritual universe and for the triumph of their God and their religion over all the infidels, that that's a small price to pay, a small price to pay. You know, Iran, in effect, under this regime, is a truck bomb. The whole country is a truck bomb, possibly a nuclear truck bomb headed our way. And that's the risk. That's the danger. Now, hopefully I'm wrong about them having the bomb at this point. I don't think I am. But that's the biggest option. You had asked about the options, which would be a nuclear EMP attack that could be launched by missile off a freighter. They actually have practiced launching missiles off a freighter in a way that is a classic signature of an EMP attack. They launch a missile to high altitude and fused it. They didn't set off a nuclear weapon, but they tested their fusing mechanisms. Something like, I think they did 6 tests like that to ensure that they could detonate a warhead in space. The only explanation for something like that is really EMP. It's the only thing that makes any sense for launching a missile, such as a Shahab 3 missile off a freighter, or a short-range missile off a freighter, and detonating it. Now, they also think time is on their side, so they may not feel the need to immediately respond to this. They might be willing to take their time. And another dimension to this is this, I think, being lost, not talked about by the mainstream media, even by the conservative media, this act against Iran, which we had to take, has also created a crisis with China, Russia, and North Korea.
Got plenty to talk about next hour. Never a dull moment with you. Our guest has been Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and he is on with us next hour. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
You can always tell it's the second hour because we're like kind of organized now.
Oh, yeah, we're ready to go.
Yeah, it's not as chaotic.
Fine-tuned.
Art fire.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know. Yeah. Our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. And Pape is one of the largest John Deere dealers in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. I mean, they have
like a zillion stores.
Yeah, they got a lot. Well, company-wide, they've got 110 locations.
That's pretty much a zillion.
I think they have 24 or 26 John Deere locations. So, yeah, they're a big outfit, but they're here to serve you. And they're located in Shasta Lake City at 3119 Twin View Boulevard. They handle everything John Deere ag and turf. So if you're looking for a tractor or a mower or any kind of attachment for your tractor, go in and see them. They have a full parts and service department and sales department. They can get you anything you want. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
P-A-P-E.
P-A-P-E, Pape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. E has a little accent over it.
Yeah.
It's pretty tricky.
Yeah. It's not Peppy.
No, no, it's not that.
It's not Peppy. A lot of calls, is this Peppy Machinery? Nope, it's not
No,
Peppy.
We're Peppy, but we're not Peppy.
Yeah,
you know?
It's Pape.
And they're also linked up on the front page of our site at wethepeopleradio.us. So there you go. I'm not going to go through the whole thing of... We did at the beginning of the show, but it is the beginning of the year, and so a lot of people like to get a little jump on stuff, and so if you live in California, you better get your real ID at the DMV, and my suggestion would be to go to the California DMV website, look up the checklist. If you have changed your name, because you're probably a girl, although they do give you the option to be non-binary now on the California DMV, just a little.
Can I be a furry, though?
Nope. You can be non-binary, though.
Non-binary.
I don't really know what that entails, but You can do that if you are so inclined. I guess inclined is the whole catch there. So anyway, if you've changed your name for someone...
My mind is racing right now with things I'm not going to say.
All the things that are not going to be said. So anyway, if you've changed your name, you do have to bring in like marriage certificates, divorce certificates, all that kind of stuff. So I really would encourage you to look at the checklist, do as much as you can online before you head to the DMV, and then for heaven's sakes, if possible, make yourself an appointment. But don't mess around, because if you need to buy a firearm, and who doesn't need to buy a firearm... if you need to fly on an airplane, do all sorts of stuff, your legal ID in California will have to be the real ID, and it takes a little bit to get that done. If your passport is current, you can use that, actually. That'll save you some time. And if you have to renew it, I learned yesterday, it's $110.
Good for 5 years, though.
Ten.
10 years.
10 years. And
10 years, $110.
Hot tip on that, too. That's sorry, I wasn't going to do this, but I did learn some stuff. Hot tip, if your passport is past the 10-year mark, you've got a spare 5 years, and you can still renew it. You can't use it. It's not valid anymore, but you don't have to start from the beginning. So if you have a passport, you're not sure how old it is, get in there and check that out. Because it's 2020, for heaven's sakes, anything could happen. It's going to be a wild ride. I don't know.
I was thinking about jumping on a private jet the other day and getting the heck out of Dodge, but I decided to stick around.
You're going to leave your private jet parked?
Yeah.
What, are you trying to help with global warming or something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my pilot wasn't available.
Yeah, exactly. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is our guest, and he has served as the Chief of Staff to the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission, the EMP Commission. He's the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, a congressional advisory board dedicated to achieving protection of the United States from electromagnetic pulse, cyber warfare, mass destruction, terrorism, and other threats to civilian critical infrastructures on an accelerated basis. So, I mean, I like all that stuff. I'm glad he's doing all that. He's also the director of the United States Nuclear Strategy Forum, which is an advisory board to Congress on policies to counter weapons of mass destruction. Foreign governments, including the United Kingdom, Israel, Canada, Kazakhstan, they consult with Dr. Pry on the EMP, cyber, and other strategic threats. So, we're lucky we have actual experts. We don't have to listen to some goofy talking head on CNN to find out what's going on in the world.
That's right.
And
get the real scoop
and
right
how
here.
It all works.
The whole story.
Mm-hmm. All right. So where would you like to pick it up this hour,
well,
Dr.
We were talking about the implications.
Are you Dr. Pry? I don't think
well,
you look like
I,
Dr.
I wanted to pick it up where we left off because it's a fascinating discussion we've been having.
All right.
And we were going to jump into the relationship with China and Russia as it pertains to recent events.
If he wants to.
If you want. I mean, it's just
okay, go ahead.
Yes, I do want to pick
oh, darn
that
it.
That's where I was going.
I was hoping you were going to tell Bill he was off base.
Because almost everybody talks about this new crisis in the Middle East just in the context of Iran and the United States. But the crisis is broader than that. Because Iran is a client state of Russia and China, and is a strategic partner by treaty with North Korea, and in fact, a partner with North Korea. Iran's nuclear program is all built on Russian technology, and in fact, the Russians are building more nuclear reactors for them. Their missile technology is a mix, is mostly from North Korea. I had mentioned the Shahab-3 before, which is their most advanced medium-range ballistic missile. Their most advanced military missile right now. That's the one that Iran today was talking about being able to strike 35 high-priority targets of the U.S. and the Middle East. The Shahab-3 is really a souped-up version of the Nodong, which is a medium-range missile developed by the North Koreans, also based on Russian technology, by the way. But the Chinese helped Iran soup up the Nodong, and now it's the Shahab-3. So it's sort of an improved version. North Korean scientists are definitely present in large numbers helping the Iranian missile program, and they're probably helping the nuclear program too. So these countries are allied together, you know, working together, and at minimum, you would describe the relationship as client states to Russia, China, and allies between North Korea and Iran. And just 2 weeks ago, you know, and this one of the things that makes this the crisis happening at this time particularly unfortunate, and the potential for escalatory possibilities particularly real, is just 2 weeks ago, Iran had a joint naval exercise with Russia and China in their own backyard in the Indian Ocean. The reason the Chinese and the Russians did that was, which was highly publicized, by the way, you know, was to send a signal to the United States to keep its hands off Iran, that Iran is their client state, that they consider them a client state, their protector, that they have they're willing to protect Iran, at least insofar as being willing to conduct joint naval exercises with them. So, after General Soleimani, who shortly before he was legitimately assassinated, you know, he was meeting with Russian officials. And just 2 weeks ago, we had Iran doing a joint naval exercise with its partners, Iran and China. And so this is a challenge, basically, to Russia and China, too. Their credibility will suffer if nothing happens, if the United States is just allowed to kind of get away with this and nothing happens. It'll also make them look weak. As for North Korea, and all of them, by the way, before this happened, were planning on challenging the United States in 2020. All of them before this happened. Clearly, you know, have an interest in the political defeat of President Trump. They don't want him reelected. He's been too strong and too effective a president. And so, you know, they were planning to raise challenges to President Trump in the United States, probably do big, scary things to try to get him, to try to convince the American people that he's reckless, he's too dangerous to have as president, to try to get him defeated in the elections so they can go back to winning the new Cold War peacefully by having a Democrat like Obama or somewhat even worse in charge of the United States, because they were winning the new Cold War for 8 years under Obama without having to fire a shot, really. I mean, that's the best way to win a war, without having to actually fight. So here's a... Now that the United States has had to do this, it gives them an excuse to escalate the situation.
Oh, sure, because we were bad.
They were planning to do it on their own anyway. Even before this happened, they were starting to do things that weren't much reported here.
We've got to take a really quick break. When we come back, you might go into just maybe a little short laundry list of those things that had happened that people probably never heard about because they were not reported. We'd be happy to get that out on the air, because that would make sense of a lot of this, I think, for people. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. sure that's the new EMP Commission theme song right there. Okay, probably not. Go ahead.
I prefer the advertisement for the Black Bear Diner. If I'm ever in your network, your neighborhood, I will have a big steak there.
You simply must go to the Black Bear Diner. There are many of them, as a matter of fact. So they're hard to miss. They're all over the place, and they're all really good. They're for hungry people. We don't have any vegan food there or any of that.
So we were talking about the allies of Iran and some
of
their...
You don't want to talk about vegan food?
No, I don't
want
to talk about vegan food.
I was going to go down a laundry list of some of the things
yes.
that have happened across the holidays.
Exactly.
One of us is paying attention.
Thank you.
That we're going to challenge the Trump administration in 2020. So they've already started, you know, the big challenge. One of the things... We all heard about the North Korean Christmas surprise, and that's still to happen. The North Koreans haven't retracted that. They're still threatening that they're going to demonstrate some spectacular new strategic weapon to punish President Trump for continuing sanctions and supposedly being unreasonable in negotiations. And you know, in effect, what they want is us to recognize them as a legitimate nuclear weapons state, despite all the talk to the contrary in these meetings about their so-called promised denuclearization. And so that's yet to happen. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of, in fact, it was kind of an absurd article published today in 38 North, which is a journal for people who follow what happens in North Korea, that said, criticized a lot of people. It didn't criticize me, but it criticized others. I noticed they didn't mention Jeffrey Lewis, who was a regular contributor to 38 North, who was warning about the North Korean Christmas surprise. And Lewis and the others were perfectly right to do it, you know. North Korea is pretty much a black box to us, and they have pretty much also consistently delivered on their threats, their escalatory threats in this nuclear realm, whether it comes to nuclear testing or nuclear missiles. Unfortunately, Kim Jong-un has been a better guide to the progress of North Korea's nuclear missile program than our own intelligence community, you know, which doesn't understand, doesn't have enough data, doesn't have enough facts to be able to, and is still our intelligence community is still largely staffed by Obama administration people, you know, and so they still tend to take a best case, head in the sand point of view toward North Korea and everything else. And, you know, so we should continue to be concerned about the impending North Korean Christmas new strategic weapon system, what was called the Christmas surprise. They never said it was going to happen on Christmas Day. That was just speculation by some people in the West, including Jeffrey Lewis. Another thing that happened is, China's got a new aircraft carrier, and they sailed it through the Taiwan Straits. Now, historically, the way we have messaged China is that we're going to defend Taiwan is we will sail an aircraft carrier through the Taiwan Straits. So it is no accident that they did that. They're sending a signal back to us. And this raises questions about, you know, is China going to go further and create some crisis over ownership of Taiwan now that it's got a more advanced Navy? You know, it's basically they've got an advantage over us in the Western Pacific, you know, because of the many intermediate-range ballistic missiles they've got that can reach out and hit our aircraft carriers and our Navy, and they've got sophisticated generations of fighter aircraft and aircraft carriers and submarines now. So a conflict with China in that part of the world, right now we probably wouldn't win it. So that's another area. And so over the holidays, they did that. They sent that signal, very little reported. And the last, but perhaps most important, was from Russia. They actually deployed their first regiment of avant-garde armed nuclear missiles. The avant-garde is one of these hypersonic nuclear warheads that it's a revolutionary new technology. It's a super weapon that Putin had warned us about deploying last March, back in 2018, March 2018, he announced to the world that Russia was going to start deploying these new nuclear super weapons, a new family of nuclear super weapons. And this is one of them. And it's one of the scariest ones, you know, because it can reach the United States more quickly, reduces our reaction time. It's very difficult, at some phases of the flight, impossible for our early warning radars to see it coming. And we can't also anticipate the target it's going to hit because it can maneuver. So the president, you know, won't know what kind of retaliatory strike options he should execute, even if he sees it coming, you know, until the thing actually hits. And because it's a maneuverable reentry vehicle, it has great accuracy. You might not even need to put a nuclear weapon on it for it to do something like destroy a hardened missile silo, because it imparts very great cruise missile-type accuracy to a ballistic missile warhead. So it could strike, instead of hitting a quarter mile away from target, which is what you can get with inertial guidance systems like the missiles we had in the Cold War, this thing could strike a silo, potentially, right on the silo lid, or maybe a few meters away from the silo, but so close that it could actually crater the silo. The Russians are conservative military planners. They have almost certainly put a nuclear weapon on the avant-garde. In fact, some of their writings refer to a 1 to 2 megaton warhead on the avant-garde. So talking about overkill, you know. So this thing could be very highly accurate and also have a very high yield to ensure the success of a first strike. And make no mistake, that's what it is. It's a surprise attack first strike weapon. And we've never faced this kind of a threat before. But it was 2 Fridays ago that they activated the 1st Regiment. You know, we're still 5 years away, 5 years away from getting the first bomber for our Strategic Triad Modernization Program. You know, we won't see the first ballistic missile submarine until after 2030. And the Russians they've already got a modernized strategic force, but now they're getting this family of super weapons to which we have no counterparts, and they're deploying them right now. And that started happening over the holidays, and we're way behind. So that's very worrisome.
Why is it that we're way behind, just out of curiosity?
Oh.
I know it's never one thing, but...
Yeah, you have to go back to the Clinton administration, really.
Yeah.
The Clinton administration, was very anti-nuclear.
Yeah.
It brought people into their administration that didn't like nuclear weapons, that believed that America's security could be guaranteed through arms control treaties, through treaty processes, in negotiations. And this isn't just a fault of the Clinton administration, by the way. I mean, you can go back to before World War II. Western democracies all believe in the treaty process. They're trying to sell the State Department. Has apparently even sold President Trump on the idea of going to the negotiating table to try to solve the Russian nuclear threat, the negotiations. The short story is, because the United States obeys arms control treaties, you know, we tied our hands behind our back. And because the Russians don't obey arms control treaties, they forged ahead in both the numbers and the technological sophistication. So we've had our hands tied behind our back since the Clinton administration. And now we're too late waking up to a situation that never existed in the Cold War, where Russia enjoys huge advantages, both numerical and technological advantages. You know, we've talked before on your show about how they've got at least 10-to-1 advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. We never allowed that during the Cold War. You know, we never wanted them to have an advantage in any category, whether it was numbers or technology. But they now, today, they've got at least a 10-to-1 advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. We know the Obama administration knew they cheated on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. These are what are called theater weapons designed to strike Europe and Asia. longer range than tactical battlefield weapons. And they've been cheating on that for years. And only President Trump had the guts to finally say, look, you guys are cheating on the INF Treaty, we're withdrawing. And we've just started trying to relearn how to do that kind of missile technology and have been testing some things. Now, the State Department still thinks and still argues that that Russia is in compliance with the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, okay? But, I mean, since they've cheated on the Tactical Nuclear Weapons Agreement, the presidential, which was called the Presidential Nuclear Initiative, and they've cheated on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, okay, it just seems to be a failing grade on an intelligence test. You know those intelligence tests where you say, complete the pattern, okay? And so you see, I don't know, you know, a bowl,
yeah,
and then, you know, some fruit going into the bowl, and, you know, I don't know.
And maybe then they pick the shoe.
Right, yeah, exactly, you know. So if you just use that kind of fill-in-the-blank intelligence test, they cheated on the tactical nuclear weapons. They cheated on the theater nuclear weapons. What are they going to do with strategic nuclear weapons?
Yeah.
State Department wants us to believe that they're not cheating on that. However, there's a lot of evidence that they are, and in a very big way. And the State Department just doesn't want to face up to that.
Well, it sounds like the people who are in charge of it are the same people who think that if we just make more gun laws, then we'll actually stop crime, because criminals always are looking to make sure that they're compliant with all the local gun laws.
Yeah,
we've got to take a really quick break here. Sorry about that.
Sure.
And we will be right back. You can just hold your breath for 2 minutes and we'll play your favorite song, too.
The nurses all gathered round, and they gazed in wide wonder at the joy they had found. The head nurse spoke up, said, leave this one alone. She could tell right away that I was bad to the bone. Bad to the bone. Bad to the bone. Bad. Justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line. When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon. We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
Best song ever. We should just play that every break.
All right. So we were discussing Russia's bad deeds.
Well, we weren't. We were just listening.
Well, we were listening.
Well, I should shut up so that you guys can talk more.
Oh, that's a really bad idea.
There's one last.
Our PhDs
last
are still
thing,
in
then
the
I'll
middle.
I'll get off my soapbox for a while and let you cross-examine me or call me crazy or whatever.
No,
we've been talking about. You know, these are bad news things that happened over the holidays,
yeah.
You know, that have so that Russia, China, North Korea, Iran have already begun the process of challenging the United States during the last year of President Trump's first term, hoping to scare the American people into not voting for him by making it seem like, well, the world is a big, dangerous, scary place, but they'd like us to blame President Trump for all this mischief, all these bad things that they're actually the ones concocting. They're the responsible parties for making the world a more dangerous place. And it's likely they'll pull out the snops in 2020 because they were doing so well under President Obama. And you had asked me another question, how did we get to this place, by the way, where we're so far behind Russia? And that's a whole show. We could talk about that at great length. But I tried to hit some of the highlights on that. But the point I want to get to now in terms of the immediate crisis, the implications of this immediate crisis in the Middle East, is one of the things that also very much concerns me is the possibility of getting into a world war through miscalculation. You know, because the it seems to me so much like what happened before in 1914, the events that led to World War One, where you had a multipolar world, and things were much slower then, and the technologies much less advanced, and the decision-making, you had days or weeks to make decisions. But even with the technologies of the time, you know, the war plans that the nations had drawn for mobilization, which was based on their railroad capabilities and the timing of, you know, picking up certain regiments and divisions to mobilize them and move them to the front, even the primitive, comparatively primitive technology of the time was so complicated that the general staffs couldn't reverse. They didn't have plans for reversing mobilization in case somebody called off the war. And so it created a situation where a single Serbian terrorist, by shooting Archduke Ferdinand in the heart and killing his wife, that one bullet, those two bullets, started the mobilization of the Ottoman Empire military forces to invade Serbia to take revenge. And then Russia started mobilizing to protect their client state, which was Serbia. And then Germany started mobilizing to protect their ally, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And France and England both started mobilizing, you know, because Germany was mobilizing. And it couldn't be reversed. And we basically stumbled into World War One that way because of the pressure of technology and the, for the time, you know, only days and weeks to make these decisions. Today, decisions could have to be made, like facing something like the avant-garde or ballistic missiles, EMP attacks, cyber warfare. You know, you're talking about making crucial strategic decisions that might have to be made in minutes or you know, actually minutes is what it comes down to, or maybe even seconds in some cases. And you're dealing with a multipolar world that's much more unstable and dangerous than the Cold War world was, where we just had to basically worry about the Soviet Union. You know, it was a bipolar world. It was a simpler world where the possible pathways to war were less. They were fewer. Now we have all these bad actors. I mean, they're all working together, but they're also independent actors with their own separate agendas. Iran, North Korea, China, and Russia, and us, you know, all with their independent interests, all of them capable of making miscalculations, and we are capable of miscalculating as well. The a lot of this, what we've been talking about, for example, the ideological dimension of Islam, that of Iran, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, that makes Iran such a dangerous actor because of its ideology, even more so than their geopolitical and economic interests, their ideology. I don't think the State Department or the Department of Defense gets that today, because in the Bush administration, when we started the global war on terror, you know, they fired our Islamic experts who taught about how Islam, you know, the radical interpretation of Islam, radical Islamic terrorism, you know, motivated, was the foundations for moving a lot of what the terrorists and what their state sponsors like Iran did. That was considered politically incorrect. The Bush and the Obama administrations didn't want it to look like it was a Christian versus Islam thing, and it became politically incorrect, and it's still politically incorrect. You know, to talk about President Trump, to his credit, when he ran, one of the things he did is he mentioned radical Islamic terrorism. He would call it out by name. But those people who used to teach that cadre of experts who were in the Department of Defense and the State Department and were in our war colleges, you know, who would teach our experts, hey, you've got, when you're thinking about Iran, you've also got to think about this dimension, the ideological dimension, because this is probably the most important thing. They haven't been there for years. For years, we haven't had people there. So I'm afraid we've got people advising the president in the Department of State and the Department of Defense who think that Iran will act like a normal nation state and they don't understand the ideological dimension of this. I also think that because our intelligence community, President Trump never drained the swamp in the intelligence community, or elsewhere, really, in the U.S. government. You know, we've replaced a few people at the top, but most of the rank-and-file analysts and middle managers in our intelligence community, he inherited from the Obama administration. You know, these are people that still have the Obama view of the world, and they don't think that Iran has the bomb. They don't think Iran has nuclear missiles yet. They think they're close, but I don't think they're there. It makes a big difference if they've got nuclear missiles now versus being close to having them. And that could be a huge miscalculation on our side that might lead us to take actions that we might not otherwise take if we realized and understood that Iran actually has nuclear weapons now, which is what I think they do have. So the possibility for miscalculation here is enormous. And also on the, and equally or even more so on the other side, you know, we've been talking about the bad guy actors doing scary things during 2020 just for political purposes, you know, to try to see that President Trump gets reelected. But the situation, I think the international situation is so dangerous, they could go well beyond that, you know. I mean, the general staffs in all these countries have got to be thinking, President Trump has started rebuilding America's military and nuclear capabilities. We're still a long way from undoing the damage of the Obama years, but we've started rebuilding them. Right now, when you look at our military forces and our nuclear forces, they're still weaker than they have, almost weaker than they have ever been. They're a little bit better off than they were at the end of the Obama administration, but not much. You know, we've been investing a lot of money in the last three defense budgets, but it's going to take years to undo the damage that Obama did. So, you know, they have in 2020, maybe instead of just seeing that Trump doesn't get reelected, maybe they'd like to deal us a bloody nose or even a more serious setback that would change the world order and push the United States off of the role of being the dominant power in the new world order and establish a new world order dominated by themselves. You know, and they could do that by Russia could grab the Baltic states. There's been a very good case made by an analyst who I respect that they might grab Belarus too in the course of doing that. They've been fighting this war in Ukraine. Who knows how far their aggression could go against both the NATO frontline states and so-called neutral states like Belarus and Ukraine. You know, if they did that and we weren't able to push back and we can't right now, you know, there's no way we can defend that part of the world. It's too far away from us. Our military is too weak. You know, even the Pentagon, even those optimists that I was talking about in the Obama intelligence community, you know, agrees that Russia could overrun, you know, the NATO frontline states in 72 hours. You know, what if China decides to grab attempts to invade Taiwan, take over Taiwan, or take islands and in the South China Sea and basically declare that a Chinese lake and everybody is prohibited from going into it? Well, North Korea could do things, and Iran might be perfectly happy to just play a provocative role. I mean, they would love to see America and Russia go to war, America and China go to war, and have the infidels wipe each other out and just be the fuse.
Sure,
they could just sit back and watch. Well, I know that we have had several times we've done shows with people from the Organization of Iranian American Communities. They have a pretty big community here in California, and throughout the Iran nuclear deal, they all said, you know, please, if they make this deal and they give them all this money, they're going to kill all the relatives that are held as political prisoners, and that will not allow us to topple the regime. That'll just keep it going. And you know, their plea was always, if America could just, you know, kind of let us, you know, wipe these mullahs out, we could get our country back. So the Iranians who live outside of the country are not fans of what's going on in their they consider themselves Persians. They actually don't introduce themselves as Iranians. They always introduce themselves as Persian, which is always pretty interesting and sends people back to look at what all that means. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to be back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, here in just 2 minutes. Celebrate a little capitalism.
Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me.
Supersonic man out of you. Stop me now.
I'm having such a good time. I'm having a ball.
Don't stop me now.
If you wanna have a good time, just give me a call.
Don't stop me now.
I'm having a good time.
Don't stop me
now. Yes, I'm having a good time. I don't wanna stop at all.
It's mostly the Trump 2020 theme song there. All right, so Dr. Pry, what if we missed here? We've got an entire 10 minutes.
Well, I'd like to talk about the best solution for Iran, which you raised just before the break, talking about the Iranian exile community, you know.
Which is a big chunk of people.
Right.
I mean, I had no idea there were that many of them.
The United States to support a revolution in Iran without the Marines going in, without U.S. putting any boots on the ground, but to support a counter-revolutionary movement in Iran, because one of the big things going for us, I mean, is the fact that the Iranian people, the vast majority of the Iranian people, hate the mullahs. They don't want to play this, be part of this end times crazy eschatological scheme that sacrifices themselves or results in a big war with the West. And they would like the mullahs out. They would like to, you know, and many of them were willing to do it, as we have seen, you know, in constant uprisings by the people, including recently, where hundreds of them have been killed by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, without any help or support at all coming from the West. Overthrowing the Iranian regime, I think would be fairly easy to do if we were to supply the counter-revolutionary forces with what they need. And this has been true for a long time. 15 years ago, back in 2005, when I was on the House Armed Services Committee, a friend and a person I was working with at that time, I was assigned to help Kurt Weldon. Congressman Kurt Weldon, he was the vice chairman of the House Armed Services Committee at the time, and vice chairman of the House Homeland Security at the committee. He was the only person who ever held was a vice chair of both those powerful committees. And Kurt was in contact. He and I were going to Paris to meet with the Iranian counter-revolutionaries. And, you know, we got to know them and their organization quite well. And, introduced them, basically. It was amazing how our CIA didn't even want to meet with these guys. Dragged their feet. They didn't want to get involved in with Iran. I think they missed a golden opportunity. They didn't need much from us. And I think our CIA has deteriorated. You know, we have got to retrain the CIA so that it's not just like a library and a research service. They used to be, in the Cold War, they used to be good at things like coup d'etats and assassinations and all the black arts that all the other intelligence communities in the world still do well. Our people don't do that very well. You know, we rely on the Department of Defense to do what should be done by clandestine services. Just look at this assassination of Soleimani, for example. It was done overtly. Our fingerprints are all over it. How come that had to be you know, if these people were still good at doing their job, now I'm probably going to get in trouble because I'm a former CIA officer for saying this, all right?
But we're
not
it's
even
true.
Supposed to say this.
Blasphemer.
But it's a fact, you know? If they were good at their job...
That's true. Why didn't
President
they sneak
Trump,
in there?
The people should be wondering, who did this? You know, there's all kinds of people in the Middle East that wanted Soleimani dead. The Israelis, his own rivals within Iran, the Iranian people, the IRGC guys knock each other off all the time for power. So, you know, a little subtlety is needed here. You know, we need a good intelligence service that knows how to do the black art operations.
They probably figured Adam Schiff was going to leak it anyway, so they might as well make a splash out of it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But since our guys are too incompetent to do it, the Israeli Mossad is one of the best in the world. You know, the Arab intelligence agencies are obviously very good. Nobody knows the area better than them. You know, we could provide resources to them to provide to the Iranian counter-revolutionary movement and, I think, solve this problem permanently.
Do kind
and
of
unfortunately,
a field
I don't
trip.
Think that's what the State Department and the Department of Defense are thinking. You know, they're thinking about Iran as being kind of like a normal nation state and that, well, surely they're going to meet with us at the negotiating table now after we did this. Surely they're not going to want to escalate further. We'll get them to the negotiating table. I mean, they're doing the same thing with North Korea, not understanding how totalitarian states work, it seems to me. They're looking at things from a Western perspective, which is the mistake we always make. And this is the kind of miscalculation that can result in a disaster, but I do think there's a golden opportunity to solving this problem, at least where Iran is concerned, you know, that's been there for many years, staring us in the face. And, I guess that's my bottom line comment on this, that an appeal to, you know, to President Trump as he thinks about the future toward Iran. I know in his speech he said he does not seek regime change in Iran. Well, as the president, he has to say things like that. As the president, he has to say things like, well, America's military is second to none in the world. What's he going to do, go up there and say what I just said?
Right.
You know,
right.
That we've never been weaker and we're far behind the Russians? That would be crazy for a president, suicidal for a president who admits such a thing. So I'm hoping that behind closed doors, maybe he at least is thinking of these options. And I hope he realizes that the current advisors who are surrounding him, and I mean the State Department, the permanent State Department bureaucrats who advise him, and the intelligence community bureaucrats, you know, who are advising his leaders that are in charge of those organizations, you know, are part of the swamp. And they're the people that need to go. And he needs to get new creative people in there, you know, who can do this on the cheap, you know,
right.
And at the least possible risk to the United States.
Well, I just hope that they can put their politics aside and actually give him good advice, because I don't know.
It's always politics first. And
yeah, I mean, I think the first thing they want to do is see him fail. So how are they going to give him good advice with thinking that way? I mean, they're in a powerful position to give him some bad advice.
Yeah, that thought crossed my mind, too. You know, that maybe they're not interested in solving the problem, but they want to get him fired, too. If we do get into another big Middle Eastern war, it's going to very seriously hurt President Trump with his political base.
Sure.
Yeah, and then we can elect one of the other guys that's running, because they're all amazing. Okay.
And it's not necessary. It's not war. This is not necessary. You know, in the 19th
True.
Century, and into the 20th century, into you know, World War I and after, up until World War II, you know, Russia and Great Britain and France played what was called the Great Game in the Middle East, you know, where they advanced their interests, and protected their national security interests, which were considerable in the Middle East, was just a handful of area specialists, people who knew the language, people who knew the tribes, people who had guns and money to spread around, and they didn't have to fight any wars. They didn't send their own armies in there to fight any of these wars. They could get the tribes to do it for them or get them fighting each other so that they didn't have to worry about that. And so with very few people, and at very low cost, they protected their interests for more than a century, advanced their interests for more than a century. And until the aftermath of World War One, I think it was around 1921, that the Sykes-Picot Agreement got translated into reality, and then they made the mistake of colonizing the Middle East, okay, which has led to all the problems we have today, you know, when they actually, when the West actually established a big footprint and presence in the Middle East. You know, but we could go back to that, you know, if our intelligence community, you know, had the right people who know the languages, who knew the tribes, you know, it's going to take a long time to rebuild that.
Yeah.
But at least the allies, our allied intelligence agencies that are in there, that area,
yeah,
you know, have those capabilities right now. And we should be, that's the route we should take. We don't need to get one more Marine killed in Iran or anywhere, you know. You know, we need to take advantage of our allies. Let them pull, this is part of them pulling their weight, you know, to serve their own interests and our national security interests, and to do it in a way that keeps our fingerprints off of it and provides plausible deniability, you know?
I think that's a I think that's a very well-made point, something that actually hadn't crossed my mind. Yeah, why didn't we get somebody else to do it? Dr. Pry, we are flat out of time yet again, but we've got to do a show on Russia. That's one subject we've skirted, and you're an expert, so we'd obviously love to have you back, and that's a great topic for us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I hope someday we can split a steak at the Black Bear.
There
Black
you
Bear
go.
Inn, right?
There you go.
We'll have some Black Bear Diner food. A little free.
Black Bear Diner, that's right.
Free
that's
plug there.
Great name.
All right, we'll take care out there in Virginia, and we'll talk to you soon. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here at KCNR 96.5 FM, 1460 AM.